Thursday once again to everybody out there at TFMR. It is actually an hour earlier than usual. It's 11 o'clock Eastern time, but that doesn't matter. It's Thursday. It's time for A to A, you know, our weekly presentation where we bring in a mover and a shaker in the metals industry, and we ask some questions. The listeners get to submit questions through the GoToWebinar platform, and it's always a lot of fun. And this week's guest is an old friend of TFMR. We haven't had him on A to A, though, for probably, I don't even know, maybe a year or so. So I thought this was a good idea to have him back. It's Rob Kirby, author, analyst, proprietor of the great site Kirby Analytics. Before I go further into his background, I'll just have Rob say hi, and then maybe I'll have him introduce himself. You could probably do a better job than I could, Rob.
Introducing myself. Rob, my name is Rob Kirby, and proprietor of KirbyAnalytics.com, and I have in a former life, I have an institutional brokerage sales background in foreign exchange and interest rate products, derivatives and interest rate swaps, which I did for about 15 years, and I used to cover probably the biggest interest rate derivatives house on the planet, which at the time in the 80s was Citibank Canada Toronto. And I've been out of the institutional markets now for quite some time. I did do 4 years as a retail investment advisor, so I know the retail side reasonably well. And I've been writing about the markets now for about 15 years.
So. You know, what's great about your perspective, Rob, is we can all sit here and see what these markets have become and recognize them for the scam and the farce that they are. But you're an actual expert in that because you were behind the scenes working in the derivatives market just as it was really growing 15 and 20 years ago. So when you say that it's a scheme and a farce, and it really has some heft to it, and that's why it's such a great advantage to have you on our side. So thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Yeah, well, my pleasure. And just to qualify that, Craig, the people that I covered, my biggest account, these were the people who created interest rate derivatives. They literally created FRAs, and they created the infrastructure as to how these derivative instruments were booked and how profits could be booked out of them. And for anybody who's listening who might find that a little bit odd, a lot of these interest rate derivatives that I speak of were actually incubated here in Toronto. Citibank, the three primary creators of the interest rate derivatives edifice were three American institutions based in Toronto at the time, Chase Manhattan, Citibank, and Chemical Bank. And Chemical Bank ultimately ended up getting wound into what now is J.P. Morgan Chase, and Chase Manhattan, of course, is the namesake J.P. Morgan Chase, and mm-hmm. Citibank. And Citibank Canada Toronto, I can tell you, used to be the clearinghouse for Citibank worldwide in these instruments, and they had the biggest book, bar none, in the 80s in said instruments. So very interestingly, and a lot of the staff who did create these very instruments here in Toronto were subsequently shipped to their New York head offices, where they continued to grow and push the product. And the other thing I'd just like to say or add to it, what these instruments were initially created to do and what they've morphed into and how they are utilized today are two completely and utterly different things. So let's just say the creation has not remained true to what it was envisioned to be when it was created. So there you go.
Let's start there then, because that was one of the main questions I wanted to ask of you. You know, there's the failure of what I have termed the generally accepted narrative of 2017 was predictable, but yet it was shoved down our throats, you know, in the morning after the election. And namely, that is, you know, the dollar was going to be king dollar again. It was going to soar. That the bond bubble was finally going to burst because Trump was going to do all this infrastructure spending and tax cuts and all this kind of stuff. And here we are 7 months through 2017, and none of that is happening. The dollar index is down 9% year to date. Interest rates are down. Then they, you know, the yield curve continues to flatten. What role do you think, you know, this big derivative complex plays in that? I mean, is to the point where, I mean, shouldn't these economists and everybody else have known better if these derivatives are playing a big role in keeping interest rates down and keeping them from rising? I mean, shouldn't these people have known better in making their forecasts that the bond bubble just almost has to continue because of the derivative complex?
Well, to answer that question, Craig, the first thing that I think is important to understand is how interest rates got to zero in the first place, mm-hmm. and how and why they got to zero or went to zero. And the reason rates were forced to zero utilizing derivatives was because we had a credit freeze back when asset-backed commercial paper failed. When this was at the height of the subprime crisis, when a bunch of misnamed or misrated paper in the subprime crisis in 2006 and 2007, which came home to roost when Bear Stearns failed. And what was at the root of the Bear Stearns failure was hedge funds that were operated within Bear Stearns, where these funds held what was rated as AAA paper. Right. And it was the first time in the history of credit markets that AAA paper failed. AAA paper in the past had been re-rated to AA or single A, or, you know, God help us, even BBB, which is still investment grade. But AAA paper had never failed. And the fallout from AAA paper failing was that we had an asset freeze or an asset-backed paper freeze, where the T-bill market more so than the T-bill market, it was the corporate paper market froze up. And the reason the corporate paper market froze up was because people no longer understood what AAA meant, because prior to this incident, AAA paper was sanctity, and people knew that they could buy and sell AAA paper on a moment's notice, and AAA paper was basically considered to be as good as cash. Mm-hmm. So what happens when people no longer believe what AAA paper is or what it's worth, is you end up with an asset freeze, and our Western economy depends on corporate paper being issued. It's sort of a transmission conduit whereby trade is affected between company A and company B. So when people suddenly don't know what AAA means, companies that want to trade goods between, like, the real economy stops. And that's what literally happened back in 2007. The economy stopped because people couldn't buy or sell corporate paper, and this panicked monetary authorities, because they realized that it was the end of Western civilization if they couldn't unfreeze this. This lockup in the paper markets. So if companies can no longer issue, if corporates can no longer issue paper, this is the lubrication that keeps the wheels of industry moving, and these wheels had stopped, and they had to restart them. So what they decided to do was to basically perform what I call, you know, in the interest rate markets, electroshock therapy. And the way they did this was this was all at the behest, in my view anyway, and what my research tells me, this was all at the behest of the U.S. Treasury, who acted in conjunction with the Federal Reserve, and specifically at the Treasury, was the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Uh-huh. And what they did was they embarked on a regime where they were selling short-dated FRAs to the using the New York Fed trading desk as a broker, and disseminating these orders out to the Magnificent Five, as I like to refer to them, which are the five major big U.S. derivatives houses, being J.P. Morgan, Citibank, B of A, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs. They started conducting these trades in FRAs, where they were selling FRAs to the banks at prices or at yields that were lower than T-bill yields. And this made the banks captive buyers of any amount of these things that the Treasury wished to issue. And they literally did trillions upon trillions of them in a very, very short period of time. And this is what caused the cascade in short-term rates from 2.5% or 3% right down to 25 basis, effectively zero. So this is what allowed them to institute the zero interest rate policy, because the banks were able to do these FRA trades with the Treasury, and then buy T-bills and lock in a risk-free profit.
Right.
Because the risk on both sides was the U.S. government. So this is how the rates got to zero. And then once they got them to zero, they used the FRA on the short end to get the banks buying the T-bills. And then they used what are called interest rate swaps, which are another interest rate derivative, which is a spread trade over U.S. government bonds, specifically with maturities between 3 and 10 years, where they could make the banks captive buyers of bonds between 3 and 10 years.
Exactly.
So this is how they manipulated the curve lower, and then they were able to keep it there through periodic generous applications of the same. So that's how rates got to where they were. And in the meantime, there's an overlay on that, because the U.S. government continued to, of course, run deficits and mm-hmm. issue more and more and more debt. Because understand, when we first started this process that I just referenced, the national debt was probably $8 or $9 trillion. Well, today it's $20 trillion. And you see, the U.S. government is now at a point where even with interest rates at close to zero, it's either the first or second biggest line item on their expenses,
yes,
annually, is interest rate debt service.
Mm-hmm.
So this is with rates at zero. So think about this, if you want to, just for a minute. The notion that they would ever be able to, like, in quotes, air quotes, normalize interest rates. To me, a normalization of interest rates would probably mean that rates would be 3 to 4 times bigger than what they are today. And to me, that would be something approaching normal, as I remember it when I was involved in the interest rate derivative market. And the notion that these things could ever be normalized would take the U.S. government's interest rate expense from, the second biggest line item to the biggest by a factor of three.
Exactly.
And they can't afford to pay it.
Exactly.
So there you go.
So
that's the pickle they're in.
Right, because you would think that as rapidly as the Fed was able to suppress rates across the curve by these instruments, you'd think they could just withdraw the instruments and move the curve back up if they really wanted to, but obviously that isn't happening.
Well, listen, Craig, just so we're completely clear on this, there has been a reduction in the aggregate amount of derivatives outstanding in the last 3 years, a significant reduction in aggregates outstanding. And there's there's more than one reason for this, but I would say one of the prime reasons was that the high water mark in terms of outstanding notionals globally in the derivatives complex was sort of right before the German regulator came down hard on Deutsche Bank. And Deutsche Bank had their offices raided by German regulator named BaFin, mm-hmm. which is a fiercely independent regulatory body. And let's just say when they went in and examined Deutsche Bank's books, I've been told by people who I know who are connected very, very highly in the let's just say in the German political apparatus, that the regulators in German, the BaFin people, were mortified when they found out just what the nature of what Deutsche Bank had been up to in with their derivatives book, and basically ordered them to make a hasty exit from those businesses. And of course, you know, in the aftermath of that, we've seen a dramatic reduction in the size of Deutsche Bank's derivatives book. So they've clearly been allowing a lot of the stuff that they had on their books to mature, and the book is being wound down. And then, not surprisingly, really, if you understand the mechanics of just what happened at Deutsche Bank, you saw in time the admissions that they had been involved in manipulating the metals, because you see the manipulation of metals and interest rates are very, very closely tied and have been historically. And I would urge your listeners to maybe do a quick Google of Gibson's paradox and gold, which explains the academic, or makes the academic argument for the relationship between interest rates and the price of gold. And this was this is a treatise, the paper Gibson's Paradox in Gold, a treatise written by Lawrence Summers and a fellow academic named Robert Barsky in the late 1980s that. It was more of a conceptual work, but it basically theorized that you could do whatever you wanted with interest rates so long as the price of gold remained neutral. And this was sort of the working theory that Lawrence Summers brought to Washington under Robert Rubin in the Clinton administration in the early 1990s, where interest rates were basically or spending was allowed to take off, and interest rates were more or less held artificially low because work was being done on the derivative front to hold the price of precious metals in check. And this is all part of another thing you could Google is Robert Rubin and his strong dollar policy, how they perpetually talked the dollar up while they were spending money like drunken sailors, and the price of gold remained moribund. And there's just a lot of evidence, documented evidence there that explains how that process works. And in all honesty, to get into a fuller argument of this would probably take a lot more time than we have available to us.
Yeah,
but the big thing is these things are all connected.
Yeah. Well, and to that end, let me just ask you one more thing, and then because I've got a pile of questions that are building that we need to get to. But to that end, if you tie in the sinking dollar, I'm getting a lot of, like, you're breathing right into the microphone, my friend.
Sorry.
That's okay.
There we go.
If you tie in the sinking dollar this year with this notion, you know, of all the jawboning about balance sheet reduction and, you know, rates should be higher and that kind of stuff, and then you tie in that mysterious appearance by Terry Duffy, the CEO of the CME Group, which owns the COMEX, on Fox Business a couple weeks ago in an interview that clearly not just off the cuff. You don't interview a CEO of a major corporation and then just hit him with whatever questions are on your mind. And he makes these statements about how gold should be two or three times higher than what it is. And in fact, with everything that's going on in the world, it should be $5,000 or $6,000 an ounce. And then he just walks away, just leaves that there and walks away. Do these dots kind of connect in what you're talking about?
Craig, I take that as a complete heads up, subtle heads up as to the, he's acknowledging that things should not be as they are. And I mean, you and I, with the work we do, we both know that things should not be as they are. And we both know that it's been, and it's funny that Mr. Duffy of the CME would say, you know, sort of the gist of his interview was that he was scratching his head to a point as to, you know, as he couldn't figure out why the price of gold was as moribund as it was. And I mean, it, you know, like, this is insincerity at its finest, because I mean, it is the CME after all who has programs where they issue and publicize incentives
right.
to have central banks and right. sovereigns to come in and trade commodities and futures.
Exactly. So,
and then to turn around, it's sort of like speaking out of both sides of your mouth. To then say you don't understand, you know, sort of why prices are depressed when you're toting the support and the business of sovereigns and central banks, and he knows exactly who his clientele is. He knows exactly
right.
Who the big movers and the shakers are in the precious metals, and it's pretty insincere of him to then turn around and says he doesn't really know why the price of gold is where it is. Well, because he knows who the sellers are. So, you know, he knows that the overwhelming volume is basically, you know, even if it's got J.P. Morgan's name on it, he knows who their clients are, because they don't allow a bank to come in and recklessly take over their exchange without finding out sort of who's behind it.
Right. So is it just kind of a heads up that this is coming? Is he kind of plowing the field to kind of, in that Gibson's paradox sense, make rates, you know, to help rates go higher, you know, as the Fed seems to want to do? I mean, what was the point of him doing that?
Well, there's a saying which I believe to be completely accurate and true, you know, and it takes us back into speaking about what's really behind a lot of things going on in our world. What we're seeing is a battle between nationalism and globalism. And the globalists have long had a premise, or it's been espoused that they have a premise, that they can't really do things unless they admit in the open what it is they're doing. And it's, for some crazy reason, it's espoused or claimed that if they say that, you know, or announce what they're going to do before they do it, it somehow makes it okay.
Yeah.
And this to me, I take as a heads up or an acknowledgement that yes, we have indeed been suppressing the price of precious metal, which is, you know, which, I mean, listen, you don't really need to have a rocket science degree or a fancy degree to realize that the price of precious metals are being suppressed. I mean, all you need to do is look at the crypto space. I mean,
right.
The crypto space are behaving the way precious metals should be behaving. Plain and simple, full stop. And frankly, anybody who would argue that, in my view anyway, is intellectually bankrupt, because this is exactly the way precious metals should be behaving. We should be seeing gold trading the way Bitcoin trades. We should be seeing gold trading with $300 and $400 ranges on a busy day. We should have seen the price of silver go from where it currently lies, $16 and change, and silver very likely in a free market would be at $700 or $800 or more right now. But these things have been suppressed to the point where it's actually become quite uneconomic for people to mine them. And we are now beginning to see reductions in supply at the pit. Steve Santangelo recently was reporting on Chile silver production down 33% year over year. Expect to see more and more and more of this because prices have been suppressed to the point where it's just not economic for people to pull the stuff out of the ground. And I expect we will see more and more of this going forward. And it's truly one of the biggest frauds, but when you're talking about fraud, the whole U.S. interest rate complex is a big fraud. So will be exposed in time.
Yeah. Well, Rob, I want to be respectful of your time. I very much appreciate you giving us those answers to my questions, but I want to move on to the questions that we have from the listeners. Again, if you have a question for Rob, click the questions tab on your GoToWebinar control panel and type it in. It comes to me, and I can relay it on to Rob. I've got a couple in queue already there, but I want to get your answer first with the question from Gabe that couldn't attend today, but he emailed it in. And he's basically noticing all of the, potential trade wars, if you will, all the geopolitics involved with the sanctions that have just been imposed on Russia, the issues, potential trade war with China and everything that's around North Korea and trade policy. At the end of the day, Gabe's question is, will they, China and Russia, retaliate by expediting any gold backing to a trade note or currency to weaken the U.S. dollar and its reserve status?
Well, my view is that much of their response has already been done, and it's been manifested in the let's just say Chinese, Russian, BRICS, with their development bank. They've been erecting in the BRICS world. They've been erecting financial platforms that mimic what the IMF does, what the World Bank does. And recently, China has developed their own international payment system, which is complete and utterly independent of the SWIFT or the CHIPS clearing system that are American centric. So these people have very, very deliberately, and I would suggest to you very quickly, have been developing a parallel system where they can literally flip a switch at a moment's notice and will be able to operate 100% and completely independent of the dollar, and the trade amongst their nations will continue in a seamless fashion. So I think that speaks directly to what the question was asking. Much of the infrastructure is largely in place now, and each day that goes by brings us a day closer to the point in time where the switch will be thrown and America will be isolated more than it is today.
Well, that's a good lead-in to the first question from a listener, actually, then, Rob. Kevin makes note of all of that and the trade wars that are building and how it looks a lot like the 1930s. He just is curious, then, is the powerful control and black money network of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, he calls it banking cabal, are they really threatened by the move east and its gold hoard, its military might, in supranational banking institutions, or is this all just kabuki theater where the East only appears to be ready to stop dealing with the U.S. dollar, and eventually they're just going to play along with the Rothschild fiat money that doesn't include gold?
I answer that by saying the amount of dark money that sits in the bowels of the Exchange Stabilization Fund, in my view, amounts to very likely trillions upon trillions, and it may actually be tens of trillions in dark money that is the underlying power that the ESF can exert on the capital markets. And, of course, exactly how much money is in contained within the Exchange Stabilization Fund or their true resources is probably the most closely guarded national secret America has. And if American dollars were to hyperinflate, and quite frankly, in my view, if the amount of money that's contained in the ESF was ever made public, the American currency would hyperinflate overnight.
Yeah, collapse.
Because it would effectively mean that instead of the perceived amount of dollars in the world being X, maybe it's 10X or maybe it's right. 20X. And that if it became public knowledge, in my view, would create a hyperinflation overnight, at which point in time the wealth or the perceived wealth to be held in the ESF would turn to tapioca overnight. Much like a Zimbabwean dollar, which in 1990 was at 50 cents American. And, I think somewhere here on my desk, I think I have a $100 trillion Zimbabwean note. And I think if you had six of them before it became completely, unusable, I think if you had six of them, you could buy three eggs. So, I mean, 600 trillion Zimbabwean dollars for three eggs. And this is a currency that was worth 50 cents American in 1990.
Yeah. Well, it does, does set us up when those dollars come home to roost, even though outside of that Exchange Stabilization Fund, just if the petrodollar status goes away and these dollars that are spread around the world in incubated in treasuries and things like that.
Yeah, but it's not only that, Craig. It's if the wealth or the perceived wealth contained in the ESF suddenly turns to tapioca.
Right.
The U.S. Treasury no longer has the ability to intervene and control global markets, yeah, because the dollars they don't spend.
Right, right. Let me ask you the next question. And this comes from regular listener Infometron. You've probably been following along, or at least have heard of this massive physical order that Andrew McGuire keeps referring to, of 250 metric tons. That is either an order or a collection of sovereign orders that he thinks are pending at this point. Infometron wants to know if you have any insight on what would happen on an order that size, and if you have any background on what would constitute a large order of physical gold. Is that a lot? What kind of premium and processing times would it take to fill an order like that?
Well, I would start off by saying anybody who had a legitimate order to purchase 250 metric tons of gold, the order wouldn't be filled, period. Because I don't believe there's 250 metric tons of gold for sale anywhere in the world at this time, certainly not at these prices. So, but that being said, it's my understanding that Andrew McGuire's perceived big order for physical gold is somehow tied to the creation of a gold-backed cryptocurrency,
right?
Where he conceivably has some very, very large orders or demand for cryptos, for this crypto experiment. And could that be the case? I would suggest yes, it could be the case where somebody has expressed, we have X amount of dollars available to purchase gold, and the problem is we can't find the supply. And but let's just say this: sovereigns in the marketplace are not known to, and have never really been known to. Well, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say they never pre-announce. They never pre-announce, orders in the fashion that he was speaking of. But of course, I have to cut myself off in saying so, because we have under the old auspices of the Washington Agreement on Gold, we used to have entities pre-announcing sales of gold. which would, of course, be, you know, use this as fuel or ammunition to push the price of gold down. But let's just say no sovereigns that I'm aware of have ever pre-announced gold purchases. And the only time that I've ever heard of a sovereign order being pre-announced has been on the sell side, not on the buy side, which would make this highly unusual for a sovereign to pre-announce a gold purchase of that amount of physical. Not to say that there would be, like my guess is, if there truly was 250 metric tons of gold to sell anywhere in the world, there would probably be four or five buyers for it, you know, in a drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the reality is there just isn't 250 metric tons of gold for sale anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's reality.
And I think his idea is if you extract somehow that from the system, it just obviously creates the leverage ratio, makes it go even higher. And then at the end of the day, can you actually find 250 tons that you can allocate and move to back that bullion coin? I know I've known Andy for years, and he has told me stories over the years of his activities and work he does with sovereign nations. I mean, I just sit here in my little hole out here in Kansas, and you know, just mind blowing the stories he's told me over the years. So it's at least consistent with what he's told me in the past about his work. So I'm going to continue to keep my fingers crossed that that he's mainly just giving us a heads up ahead of time.
Yeah.
But let's hope that's what it is.
And further to that, Craig, if somebody were seriously intent on securing 250 metric tons of gold in physical form, and if they were to execute those orders through you know, let's just say traditional market conduits, I'm sure you would probably push the price. I would guess maybe you might push the price of gold up to over $2,000 to get an order like that done.
Yeah.
Because the reality is on a selective basis, Craig, the price where gold's being transacted a lot of times between sovereigns is at a very big premium to what we know as the spot price anyway.
Because the spot price is determined by paper trading, and
that's
the
right.
Physical price, when you're talking in size, it's like we're not working off of some bullshit price, you know, discovered on the COMEX. If I'm going to give you physical in exchange for something else, it's going to be this price.
Sure, but and people should understand that even the physical gold market is extremely bifurcated in that raw gold coming out of Africa often sells at steep discounts to spot. Gold at retail, most of us would be able to relate to going into a coin shop and buying silver eagles or silver maples or gold or eagles or maples, and that trade tends to, I guess in the case of gold, probably happens the bulk of it probably at spot plus 2 or 3%. In the case of silver coinage, sovereign coinage, probably spot plus 10% ish. As general rule sticks, typically or a lot of times, I know that you can buy junk silver probably like that melt value, which is spot or maybe possibly just under spot. But then these hard to find chunks can sometimes be traded at spot plus 20 or 30%.
Yeah.
And for people who are sitting on trillions of dollars in their exchange accounts and want diversification, who know that ultimately they will be left with a bag of dollars they can do nothing with. People who know that they're going to be ultimately left with a bag of dollars, if they pay a premium today to buy a chunk of precious metal, it doesn't faze them at all.
Yeah. Rob, just in name of time, I only have one last question, actually. And actually, it's a point of clarification. You mentioned FRAs earlier. What is an FRA?
It's referred to, or like when I was involved in them, we called them forward rate agreements.
Okay.
And some people refer to them as future rate agreements. And what they are is a bet on what LIBOR will be at a future date. So these things are typically denominated in 3, 6, 9, and 12-month intervals. So let's just say a 1 by 4 FRA would be a bet on what 3-month LIBOR is going to be in 1 month. A 1s13 FRA would be a bet on what 1 year LIBOR is going to be in 1 month. A 6s12 or a 6x12 FRA would be a bet on what 6 month LIBOR is going to be in 6 months. A 12s24 FRA would be a bet on what 1 year LIBOR will be in 1 year.
Mainly just used as a hedge, I would think, right? Against some other position?
Sure, and typically they are traded against a strip of Eurodollar futures.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. I'm going to just throw this one last one in quick, really quick for you, Rob, because I want to be respectful of your time, and we'll get to the final four. Just one last quick question came in. If there's a sudden spike in price in gold or silver, do you foresee the miners following the metals or the general stock market? You know, if there's a spike, a big meltdown occurs in the stock market, but that spikes the metals. Which way do the miners go? Do they follow the stock market or do they follow the metals?
It's a really good question, and I can't even really say I know with certainty what the answer would be. Just believe this, that I would guess that the biggest owners of the mining equities are probably investment banks and hedge funds. And if these guys are put on notice and have margin calls up the wazoo, they're going to sell anything they can to raise liquidity. I have never been a proponent of putting money or putting my investment dollars into the equities, precisely for the reason that I know that the underlying metal is manipulated beyond belief. And until that manipulation is broken, I don't really believe that equities can really achieve what they should, in theory, achieve anyway. And the other thing being that if equities are able to ever achieve the prices that they should, if metals are allowed to trade free, I do think at that point in time, the only way that happens would be under a scenario where government finances would be really, really, really shaky. And what do governments do when their finances are shaky? They look for places to get money. And I do believe that they would ultimately end up scapegoating the people who made out like bandits in the metals equities, and you'd end up getting surtaxed beyond belief because there's a paper trail for all that stuff. So that's why I believe, and I'm a very, very strong advocate for owning physical metal, because ultimately, physical metal will be the only thing that stands.
Yeah. And one last point of clarification from Kevin. Do you see the dollar crashing with higher rates at the onset, or do rates just fall through the floor again and that as the dollar then goes down with it?
Interest rates are 100% arbitrarily set, and any talk that the market or the market is what sets interest rates is complete fallacy in my view. They can keep rates wherever they want for as long as they want, because they have the ability to make banks captive and risk-free buyers of any amount of U.S. government debt.
And so the rates could stay wherever they want them to be, and then
rates
we'd still have
down.
This going in the background, and we'd have this dollar
rates
stuff.
Could go down as the dollar fails.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, all right, my friend. I want to wrap up here and get you on your way. You've been very, very generous with your time, as you always are, and it's, boy, just fabulous conversation. But we have this tradition here as we go where you get the final four, just four quick, fun questions on your way out the door. If you're ready, can I hit you with number one?
Yep.
As you mentioned, you live in Toronto, and so what the heck is an Argonaut?
It's something that's chasing, looking for the golden fleece.
Is that right?
Well, anyway, it's got to do with Greek mythology. Yes,
that's
and,
right.
And it also happens to be the name of the Toronto entry in the Canadian Football League, Toronto
Hurricanes. That's exactly right, which is why I asked you that.
So, but let's just say the way they play football in recent years, it's a myth that we really have a football team to be.
And that is the right answer. It is a band of Greek warriors, but it's also an octopus. So I thought that was interesting. All right, number two, have you ever eaten at that restaurant at the top of the, what is it, the CN Tower?
Yep, been there.
Is it a nice view?
If you like heights, yes, but I don't, so I don't like it so much.
All right, who stays in power longer, Trump or Kim Jong-un?
Great question. I would actually be willing to toss a loony and make a bet with you on that.
So who is it?
Because I don't know what the answer is.
You have to guess. What would it be?
Boy, I'd say Kim Jong-un.
And then lastly, have you seen the movie Dunkirk?
I have.
And what'd you think?
Spectacular.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. It is all engulfing, and it is exhausting, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
And I got one listener who just keeps sending the same question to me, begging for me to ask it of you on our way out the door. So I see it now, Ron. So one last thought for you, Rob. You were touching on the mining shares earlier, and Ron says he's torn on holding them until hyperinflation, but he also worries about, you know, the brokerage houses stealing them and all that kind of stuff. He says, I am torn to hold on to these until hyperinflation or sell faster if the brokerage houses steal our shares or the system completely crashes, thereby losing my shares. And I think you mentioned that's why you own the metal, because of all those risks.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough. My friend, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. It's been tremendous 45 minutes, and we'll get this posted for everybody later this afternoon. But hopefully we will discuss things again in the near future, because your wisdom and experience is invaluable to all of us here at TFMR. So thank you, Rob.
Pleasure being with you.